It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll check in with regular science contributor Gemma Tarlak about some of the biggest headlines in science, from news about Pluto expected next month to a theory about why humans are able to cooperate with one another.
But first, on ABC's This Week yesterday, Governor Scott Walker talked about same-sex marriage and possible responses to a U.S. Supreme Court ruling expected later this month.
If the Supreme Court establishes that same-sex marriage is a constitutional right, does that effectively end this as a political issue in this campaign?
Well, I personally believe that marriage is between one man and one woman. If the court decides that, the only next approach is for those who are supporters of marriage being defined as between one man and one woman, is ultimately to consider pursuing a constitutional amendment.
So you would favor a constitutional amendment that would say that states are allowed to ban same-sex marriage?
I believe that the decision on defining marriage should be left up to the states, yeah.
Steve Bragaw joins us now for more on a possible constitutional amendment. He's a visiting professor of politics at Washington and Lee University. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, guys.
Well, if the U.S. Supreme Court decides, and there's a decision expected this month, that state bans, the remaining ones on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional, would this federal constitutional amendment be the only remaining option for opponents?
Well, in theory, yeah. What they would have to do depends on how the court would actually define in the decision what would be the basis for that. And if it was defined in a very broad way, then probably the amendment process would be the only way to really try to overturn that.
Now, the issue at play in the courts, or one of the issues, and the one that Governor Walker is raising, has to do with the power of the states, on one hand, versus the power of federal government, the courts in this case, to override state laws. Is this the kind of thing we often see making its way up to the Supreme Court?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is totally exactly the type of thing you see in the wheelhouse, if you will, of the Supreme Court, because it gets right to the core issue of the traditional powers of the states, one of which is defining basic contracts, of which marriage is one of your basic forms of contract, versus the federal government's protection mandated through or guaranteed through the 14th Amendment to ensure the equal protection of the laws, not just of federal citizens, but of all persons in the United States, specifically to make sure that the laws of the states are not violating the federal rights of people residing in the United States.
So if opponents of same-sex marriage decided to go this way, what would have to happen to get the ball rolling on a constitutional amendment?
Well, sure. It's actually the process is actually pretty simple. It's simple to describe. It's very hard to
actually
to navigate. Yeah. And so basically there's two tracks that you can go. The one track, which has never been successfully done, would be calling a constitutional convention. And what you would need for that would be a proposal that would go out, and the same proposal, the same language would have to be go out and be ratified by two-thirds of the state legislatures, which would then be able to create a convention. And then the convention would not be bound to this particular type of question. There was a movement for this back in the 1980s to add a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution by going the convention route. And part of the language that is kind of cooked into this is that the convention wouldn't be bound to that particular issue. In fact, that's how the whole federal convention, which created the Constitution itself, went. It was called for a more specific thing, but decided it wasn't bound specifically by that and went more broadly. So the convention route has never occurred, although it could very well happen at some point. But the more common route, the way the Constitution has been ratified successfully the other 27 times, is you go through the Congress. And the president actually doesn't play a role in this. This is sort of one of these sort of basic misunderstandings that people think that this is something the president has to initiate. The president actually doesn't play a role in this. Basically what you have is a bill paper emerges in both houses of Congress that is calling for the same thing. It has to go through the ordinary committee process. And what then you need to have happen is that you have to get two-thirds majorities in each house for the same language for it to then go out to the states to be approved. And then each of the states can go one or two routes. They can either have it be ratified by the legislature, or they can call a special convention to approve that particular to approve the amendment, and then it has to be approved by three quarters of the states. So the hurdles you would have to pass in the House, you'd have to get 290 people. In the Senate, you'd have to get 67, and then it would have to go out to the states, and you need 38 states to do that. So the process has only been successfully navigated 27 times. There were 33 amendments which made it out of this process, but there's been thousands, depending on how you want to count. There's over 10,000 amendments that have been proposed through the congressional route. In recent years, in the past couple of decades, there's been about 200 of these that have been introduced in either the House or the Senate, about 100 a year. So if you kind of think of it, they're not they're in session about a little over 100 days a year. So if you kind of think about it, it's almost one a day goes in. And so it's one of these things which sounds very rare, but is actually quite common for these things to be introduced in Congress. But to get them out of Congress is very rare. It's quite an event.
Talking to Steve Braga, he's a political scientist looking at constitutional amendments following Governor Scott Walker, likely presidential candidate Scott Walker, mm-hmm. saying he'd look for a constitutional amendment on same-sex marriage. Some other Republican presidential contenders have done the same. So long odds as you lay it out there, Steve. Do you think when a presidential candidate is talking about this, the intent is more politics than something they expect to really happen down the road?
Oh, well, of course. I mean, well, or a way to kind of think about it is politics, that there's two sort of dimensions of going on. First of all, you're kind of in a way sending a message to the Supreme Court itself, because the court is sitting on the case, or the group of cases right now, the four cases from Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee that they're expected to have a ruling on. But we know the justices well enough to know that they're not going to be swayed by what presidential candidates are saying in the press for the most part. But certainly what this is about, my reading of this, is definitely trying to define options for among the Republican candidates, but also kind of send a message on the Democratic side as well. So certainly the political dimension of this is trying to define the agenda for the election coming up next year, and then also with it to try to define your place within the candidate hierarchy. And by proposing a constitutional amendment, you're trying to send a sort of a note of gravity that you know, as president, you want to uphold the Constitution, and the way to do this is the Constitution provides a mechanism, even if it's a very difficult gauntlet to run. That's the way to do it. So there's really nothing hurt that's going to hurt you as a candidate saying something like that, but it's not something which is really going to have a practical short-term victory.
And Steve, if I can wrap up on this politics side, I've seen some observers say, okay, this is something that might help a Republican candidate in the primary process, might be something that haunts them in a runoff because the country has changed over the last 10 or 20 years on this issue. Is there a balancing act here?
Oh, absolutely. And it's not even just in the past 10 or 20 years. It's in the past 2 years. The last time the Supreme Court took one of these cases was in June 2013, and only 9 states in the District of Columbia allowed same-sex marriage. And now we're up to we're into the 30s now. There's been 36 states just in 2 years. Now, most of those have become judicially. Several have come through the legislative or voting process, and we all just saw what happened in Ireland. You think one of the last countries in the West which would vote for same-sex marriage by vote would be very Catholic Ireland, but they went ahead and did it. So the politics of this have definitely changed, not just in the past 20 years, heck, just in the past 2 years.
Steve, thanks a lot for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Braga. He's a visiting professor of politics at Washington and Lee University.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss a survey that shows that women lose ambition for higher-level positions, those management jobs, after just a few years on a job, and maybe how companies can change that.
First, there's news expected about Pluto next month as the New Horizons mission from NASA makes a close flyby study of the dwarf planet.
We'll get a preview of this new look at the former planet and talk about some other headlines in the science world, including the treatment of autoimmune diseases with parasites. and how self-domestication might be the reason for our species' success.
Gemma Tarlak joins us now. She does every month to talk about science news. She's a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and a very happy Monday to you.
Back at you. Well, let's start with this big news about Pluto. What's going on next month?
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so just about on or about July 14th, the New Horizons spacecraft is going to whiz past Pluto and do a flyby that is going to be really exciting for a number of reasons. Now, to back up a little bit, yes, Pluto was demoted. It's not a real planet anymore, whatever. But in a way, because it was kind of kicked off the planet pedestal, we're actually learning a lot more fascinating stuff about it, and New Horizons is going to kind of maybe hopefully confirm some of the theories we have about it and also give us never-before-seen glimpses of the planet itself. Now, Pluto is part of the Kuiper Belt. That's this vast area beyond our solar system. It's kind of considered the third zone of our solar system, and it's full of really fascinating stuff and countless objects zipping around there. And Pluto is kind of considered the ambassador of the Kuiper Belt. So it's kind of our gateway drug into the Kuiper Belt, if you will, where astronomers are expecting to find really incredible, fascinating things.
Yeah, the Kuiper Belt. And I had to look up the pronunciation because it looks like Cooper or Kuiper Belt, but Kuiper Belt. What all is out there? How much stuff is out there in that distant zone of our solar system?
I cannot tell you how much stuff is out there because they don't even know. There's seriously countless items.
Like comets. Maybe hundreds of thousands, maybe more?
Maybe more. There's everything from, you know, tiny rocks, asteroids, comets, other dwarf planets, crazy moons of Pluto that do nutty things. We're just really at the tip of the iceberg figuring out what's in the Kuiper Belt. But Pluto is certainly one of the most intriguing objects out there and one of the largest.
Why is NASA so interested in Pluto now that it's been demoted? What changed?
Well, there are a lot of reasons to be interested in Pluto. And, you know, one of them is Pluto may have some really important clues about the earliest days of our solar system. There's a theory that Jupiter was kind of moving around closer to the sun, further out, whatever. And then when it really started going further out from the sun and ended up in its current location, it kind of shoved everything out of its way and shoved Pluto and other objects out into the Kuiper Belt. And they think that because of that, Pluto and some other Kuiper Belt objects may actually preserve some really important information that will help us better understand how our solar system formed.
So this is maybe some data left over from billions of years ago when our solar system was kind of shuffling into place?
Yeah. It was kind of, you know, like, I don't know, like a pinball machine. And this could have a lot of the clues for us to better understand it. And Pluto in and of itself is really fascinating. You know, it's got this crazy atmosphere that's estimated at 350 times the volume of Pluto itself. And, you know, they also think we have, like, really kind of hazy imagery at this point of Pluto. New Horizons is going to give us much better images of the planet. And we think it may have really exciting terrain, like, you know, actual huge mountains and deep valleys and stuff, just by the kind of fuzzy little shadows that we can see in the imagery we have. So I think it's always super exciting when we get to learn about, you know, those corners of our solar system that we really haven't been able to study close up. So I'm expecting great things.
Well, we're going to be talking even more about Pluto on the 15th of July, so we can take stock a little bit later again, take a look at Pluto. We're going to move on now and talk about how people with autoimmune disorders are treating themselves with parasites, and in particular, hookworms.
Hookworms.
That's
voluntarily.
Right. I should know that from its close-up of its little face
right.
with its fangs. Hookworms. Why would someone want to do that, Gemma?
Well, I have to start this by saying, caveat, you know, don't just try this at home and go, like, sticking parasites on yourself. But, you know, there have been some studies, and actually one of the participants of a study in England had such great results when they infected him with parasites that he went off on his own and started a little DIY. And he's really the character that we follow in this story because he had suffered for years from extreme food and environmental allergies, Crohn's disease, other really, you know, kind of life quality affecting issues. So he got infected with hookworms, and all of a sudden, he got better. He was able to eat foods he hadn't been eating for years, etc. So when the study was over, and, you know, the hookworms, they don't live forever, so you got to keep resupplying yourself, he found a way to resupply himself, and now he's just this leading advocate of, you know, if you have certain autoimmune problems, try a hookworm.
And the way this works, if I'm reading this right, it's hookworms have this evolutionary stealth. They're like, I'm going to parasite on you, human, but I've evolved the ability to reduce the inflammation that happens when I do it. And then that translates over to maybe reducing other kinds of inflammation at the same time.
Exactly, exactly. Basically, what's happened is, you know, a really good parasite knows how to live and thrive in its host without killing its host. So that's why they think hookworms have evolved, you know, millions of years aside hominids like us, and figured out a way. The technical stuff is basically they inhibit a certain kind of T cell, and that particular kind of T cell triggers inflammation. So by the worms inhibiting it, that seems to reduce inflammation across the board. So it's really fascinating stuff. And in addition to people ordering hookworm larvae off the internet and putting it on their arms so the worms can burrow in. I will leave you with that mental image for a moment. Let's pause. But in addition to folks kind of taking the DIY approach, there are actually a lot of researchers looking into this in a much more, you know, clinically controlled environment and possibly developing drugs off their skills, off those hookworms' mad skills.
Right, so eventually it won't have to be you get hookworms, they burrow into your arm painfully. Sounds like researchers are working on pills from hookworm excretions, for instance.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, I don't think it's painful as much as itchy. That's how the guy describes it. But I really don't want to spend too much time thinking about what it feels like for larva to burrow into my arm, I got to say.
Okay, we'll move on then. We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, checking out some of the most intriguing stories from the science world. Now, humans, right, we've domesticated a lot of species, dogs, cats, you name it. Turns out maybe we domesticated ourselves, and that's why we can live with each other mostly without beating each other up all the time. Maybe?
Yes, yes. And, you know, the funny thing, if you spend a lot of time on, say, I don't know, comment threads on online stories or on Facebook, you might think we do not get along. But the truth of the matter is, when you compare us to our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, well, let me put it this way. One of the researchers in the story says, you know, every day millions of Americans go to the movie theater, and we sit in a movie theater full of strangers, and at the end of the movie, no one is dead or impregnated. And if you had chimps watching a movie, that would not happen. There would be bloodshed. There would be all kinds of issues. So he really thinks, and he's one of a number of researchers, who thinks the key to our success as humans has been self-domestication over millions of years. That has enabled us to share information, build more elaborate tools, more elaborate settlements, cities, civilizations, and so on. So it's really kind of fascinating, and it's especially interesting how they're finding evidence of that in the fossil record.
So how would a species domesticate itself? I think of it as needing an outside agent.
Well, actually, self-domestication, and another good example is the bonobo. That is another very close relative of ours. And bonobos, they think, kind of self-domesticated themselves. And basically what happens is the individuals select for, say, a less aggressive mate. Maybe and I'm way oversimplifying this, I want to make sure that's clear, but maybe, you know, instead of going for the really big burly guy who beats other people up to win a mating contest, maybe you go for the guy who's just really good with kids. You know, that's like a gross oversimplification, but it's basically about selecting who gets to reproduce, and then those traits are passed on. And sure, it can happen, you know, within a species. We don't need an outside agent.
So this would be an evolutionary pressure rewarding cooperation over conflict, at least in some cases, that over millions maybe of years would add up into being able to live in a city with millions of other humans.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, one of the ways they see in the fossil record is if you go back more than 4 million years ago to Ardipithecus ramidus, and that's going way back in the fossil record, but you see something interesting. That is the first hominid that has reduced canines, you know, those big old kind of fangs on your teeth, and that's really unusual for a primate. If you look around most primates have really large canines, especially the males, because those are used in, you know, kind of fighting another male for the right to mate. And they're starting to see the reduced canines 4.4 million years ago in our ancestors, making them think that, yes, over time, very slowly, you're starting to select for less competitive, more collaborative behavior.
So, Gemma, before we let you go, how unusual is this notion of self-domestication among human ancestors?
Well, you know, it's certainly a theory that's out there. And I think you would find that most researchers agree that we have done something in our lineage that has allowed us to be far more collaborative and really, you know, more like curious about strangers rather than just, stranger, kill him. So there is definitely something. I think there's a big range of opinion exactly when it happened in the fossil record. I think most people will agree it took millions of years to happen. But, you know, I think just looking around, just, you know, the fact that the technology we're using right now just to talk over the phone, elaborate stuff like that would not have evolved and developed if we hadn't evolved to be domesticated.
Well, Gemma, thanks a lot for talking. It's been great as always.
Always fun with you guys. Thank you so much.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science headlines.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. There's been a growing awareness of the gender gap for women in leadership roles in companies across the country lately, and researchers at the consulting firm Bain & Company wanted to find out why.
According to a recent survey the company conducted, women are more ambitious than men to hold a leadership role in a company early on in their careers, but that ambition apparently plummets like about 60% after just a few years.
The survey tried to find out why women were turned off by leadership roles and what businesses could do in order to support and encourage their female employees. We're joined now by Julie Coffin, partner for Bain & Company and the chair of the company's Global Women's Leadership Council. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Hello.
Well, Julie, according to the study, what happens to women's ambition to make it to top leadership over time?
Well, it's exactly as Rob said. It plummets after just a few years, down 60%. And what the research was trying to understand were some of the drivers behind that, because, again, it started out equal or ahead of that of men. And along with aspirations, confidence that they could achieve those top jobs also dropped substantially in those first few years of employment.
And you say that initially in the classroom, women are ambitious. At the beginning of that first employment at a company, they are ambitious. But something happens over those first few years. What do we know about what might be going on there?
Yeah, what we did is tried to look at the groups separately, those that still had high aspirations after those first few years versus those where those aspirations had dropped, and tried to say what's different about those groups, what has changed. And we saw three primary drivers that we believe is behind this drop in aspirations. Number one, those that no longer aspired for top jobs were having a very hard time envisioning a path to get to the top. They either didn't see that there were people like them around the top of the company, or that their style wasn't as valued at the top of the company. The second thing that was cited was they didn't seem to believe that their day-to-day manager truly supported them or encouraged them to try and reach for the next level or to push themselves in new directions. And the third element was all around role models in terms of whether or not they believed that there were people that they could not only look up to and see a path to get there, that was the first category, but also just saw people that they wanted to be like and that inspired them to try and reach the top of the company. So for those folks with the drop in aspirations, we think those elements were the key drivers there, which has a lot more to do with the day-to-day experience for women on the job than necessarily the policies or programs that are in place at the corporate level.
So what happens to men during those same years?
It's a good question. What we saw was that the men had very little drop in aspiration comparatively, and in particular seemed to feel very supported by their supervisors. And that was the biggest gap that we could see across the genders. And we thought about that a little bit and realized that 80 to 90% of the bosses, if you will, are still male out there, just given the disparity we see in people in managerial roles. And so the one-on-one dialogues that you really need from a manager to an employee to build that relationship, maybe get that one-on-one coaching, get some encouragement and some belief that you're going to support that employee to reach the next goal, those one-on-one relationships weren't forming as readily with a male boss and a female supervisee, if you will. It wasn't as natural necessarily to find those times to connect outside the workplace or even inside the workplace. A lot of what we found was that men might have been more uncomfortable having some of those kinds of conversations with their women subordinates than they might have been with their male counterparts.
Right. So does that seem to indicate to you that women need a different kind of relationship with those managers, those supervisors, than men do?
I think what I'd say is that they need, probably both men and women need the similar relationship in terms of feeling supported and feeling that they can go to their boss with challenges, opportunities, and coaching requirements, but that the women are finding the lack of that particularly damning at this point in their career. So it's access to those kinds of relationships and the approaches or the tools to build those relationships that seem to be missing for the women as much. And the guys, I think, tend to take it a bit for granted. And so my belief, just talking to my own colleagues, is that both men and women need that encouragement and support of supervisor. It just seems to happen more naturally for men, and the absence of it is having a huge impact on women and on their desire to keep moving up and to feel like there's a path for them into leadership roles.
Well, part of that sounds like a catch-22, doesn't it? If you're saying that male supervisors are less likely to connect with women employees outside of work, maybe uncomfortable with them, and women need that sort of relationship with their supervisor, and there aren't as many women supervisors. So how do they get it then?
Yeah, no, I think you hit on a really important point, which is, you know, on the one hand, if we don't do something, we don't make some sort of intervention here, we're going to end up in that doom loop you just described. And so part of it, I think, has to do with training and acclimating managers, but be they male or female, as to what does it take to build the sort of relationship with your the people you're supervising that nurtures their aspirations, male or female, and trying to help people get past what might be initially awkward or uncomfortable moments. So giving some more training or support on how to make those connections, how to reach out and sort of offer encouragement, asking questions, for example, instead of just giving directives, I think can build a more open relationship and they can share perspectives more easily. At the same time, I think that the women themselves have to recognize that they have to be proactive in seeking out actual coaching, support, and advice from their bosses and not wait for it to be handed to them on a silver platter. So both sides might need to think a little bit more strategically about how to build those connections, because the absence of those relationships seems to really be hurting women's ability to continue to climb the corporate ladder.
Now, looking again at the causes of the effect here, one interesting thing in the survey is that marriage and motherhood, having kids, didn't seem to have a place here in the reason why a woman wouldn't pursue an upper-level management position. Were you surprised by that?
Yeah, we were definitely surprised, and I guess I want to be careful on how I phrase it, because what we'd say is if you look at the two cohorts, those that still aspired after 3 or more years in the job and those that did not for top roles, and then you ask yourself, is there a difference between the percentage of those women that had kids or did not? There was no difference across the groups. So what our conclusion was that it was not a primary driver. It wasn't as if everyone that used to have high aspirations went away, had kids, and now no longer had those same aspirations. But instead, that in and of itself didn't explain the lack of aspirations. I want to be clear, though, clearly having children and having families adds additional complexity and complications to both men and women, frankly, that are sharing in parental roles. So what we would say is that in and of itself is certainly not the killer of aspirations that oftentimes it's painted to be. And therefore, while it's an important consideration in terms of what are the needs of employees that are balancing work and family issues, it is not the driving factor here. Beyond what the supervisory role is, the other point that I would just also make is that this idea of envisioning success and being able to figure out if you fit into what is rewarded at your company, if you fit what we call the ideal worker stereotype or not, or whether or not companies have done a better job of saying there's not just one model of success, but there's multiple models, can also help women feel like they don't have to fit into an archetype that they may not be comfortable with.
We're talking right now with Julie Kaufman about a recent study that shows how many companies drain women's ambitions. After a few years on the job, they're not as ambitious, not as likely to go for those upper-level jobs anymore. And Julie, we're talking about some aspects of this, including you mentioned the ideal employee issue and maybe a stereotype that the ideal employee works 60 hours a week. They're available 24/7. And it sounds like some women are looking at that and saying, I don't want to do that. I can't be that. What did you find
there? That's right. Yeah, and I think it's really critical to think about the way in which companies, whether they realize it or not, but the people that they showcase as the top performers, the people that get the promotions, or the people that are celebrated at big end-of-year meetings, if they all fit a similar pattern, if they look the same, if they sound the same, and if the way in which their accomplishments are described make it sound like they'll run through walls to get that next sale or do whatever it takes to close a deal, at some level you're not necessarily motivating everybody else that says, gosh, I'm not sure I can ever be that person. Is there a way in which I can still give my all to my assignments, to my customers, do a great job, but still be able to manage other aspects of my life? And where are the folks like that that are celebrated? And if people start to get the impression that they are the people that are at the top of the company are superhuman in some way, it's gonna eventually turn them off to believe they can fit in. And I think it's an important element for companies to really look at who they celebrate, what they reward, how their bosses talk about their own personal lives and trade-offs, and whether or not they're creating an atmosphere where there's a variety of models that can make it, or creating an atmosphere that if you don't fit this one model, you might have to go somewhere else.
And living up to that model of the ideal employee, does that disenchant more women than it does men?
It seems like for, and our research would show that it does, and that part of that might go back to the fact that the very numbers describe that there are more men than women at these senior roles to begin with. So as it is, women may not feel like they, quote, fit in from a pure demographic standpoint. And then when you overlay some of those attitudes or some of those impressions of how much you have to be always on or working 24/7, that seems to add to the fact that women would say, gosh, I'm just not sure I ever can be or want to be that person. Well, I would also say, though, that I think as more and more men, especially our younger generations that we see that we're hiring now, the millennials as they're called, and more folks are sharing parental responsibilities more in a partnership manner, that I think that there's plenty of men out there that also would, chafe at that stereotype, so to speak, or not want to be in that role. And figuring out a way that we can make it possible for people to see leaders in a light that they're people that they want to become, and see role models or aspects of their behavior that are more accessible, that'll help both men and women in this quest to proceed in their careers.
We're talking right now with Julie Kaufman from Bain & Company about a recent study they did that shows that some companies are draining women's ambition, and gives advice on how companies can keep their employees engaged.
And we want to hear from you. Does your workplace encourage you to advance, to maybe enter the world of management? Have you had a supervisor who was particularly good or bad at that kind of encouragement? Does this play out differently the same way for men and women where you work? Have you worked at a company for a few years and feeling, wow, I could never do that. I could never become a manager. I don't see a path from here to there. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking now to Julie Kaufman about what companies can do to encourage more women to go after leadership roles. And we want to hear from you on this. Have you felt less inclination to hold a top position at a company after working there for a while? What made you feel that way? And are you a manager that works with and tries to encourage women to go after those higher roles? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Julie, for companies that are having this goal of keeping women engaged, having women in leadership roles, what is the benefit to the company?
Well, there's, I think, several different benefits, and we at Bain have been absolutely embracing the opportunity to try and do this for ourselves, because we think that there's two or three things that are most that really the outcomes are. Number one, we think that having a more diverse talent pool tends to lead to better outcomes. There's more creativity and thought. There's more innovation and problem solving. There tends to be a lot of different perspectives that can be brought to situations that's beneficial. The second thing is a pure numbers thing, which is, look, more than 55% of university graduates are women in the developed world these days. And the talent pool, therefore, has got a lot of women in it. And if by the time you get to management or senior level roles, you're seeing only 20% or less are still female, that means that you're losing an awful lot of talent on the way, and that re-recruiting and retraining is awfully expensive. And finally, I just believe that the customers out there, more and more purchasing power, if you will, in many industries is concentrated in the hands of women, whether it's healthcare, whether it's consumer products, whether it's retail. The list goes on, and with more diversity in terms of the ability to think through the products, the innovations, the service experience that those customers and clients want, we think that it's going to lead to a better understanding of the customer needs, and your company will be better able to respond to those needs and opportunities.
Are companies that do have better gender equity seeing those results already?
There are. You know, there's a lot of different research out there that demonstrate that share prices, if you look at publicly traded companies with at least three board members that are women as opposed to less than three, you could see a demonstrable difference in the overall market capitalization and the current share price of those publicly traded companies. We've also seen in our own research that when you have companies with better gender representation as well as a belief that there's more equal opportunity, both policies as well as programs to help promote flexible working, et cetera, that you have more engaged employees. People are more happy and willing to recommend the company, and that tends to lead to higher growth for those companies. So we've seen that there are benefits around employee engagement, around growth rates, and around overall valuations of publicly traded companies.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We've got Carla with us from Stevens Point. Hi, Carla.
Hi. I just have a comment on this issue. As a person who's 67 years old, I've been a wife and mother and gone through the whole bit, and I've been working since, I hate to think how long, probably, 40 years? I'm not retired yet, and I have noticed as the years have gone by that I have less and less respect for leadership. There's poor leadership in a lot of companies. I work in the healthcare industry. I'm disgusted by leadership. Why would I want to be part of that? And I do contract work now, temporary positions, because of that disgust. At least I can go in, assess a situation, do something, and feel pretty good about myself.
So, Carla, I want to make sure I got you. Yeah. Are you saying that lack of leadership at the top affects the way women function in the workplace?
Yes, lack of integrity in the leadership, lack of true leadership. People, I think, nowadays are just sucking up for the next little immediate benefit they can get at the very top levels.
All right. Thank you so much, Carla. I want to make sure we can get Julian on this. And Julie, I don't know, is there a problem there that in some cases people at the top in these leadership roles need to clean house and make sure that they're putting their best foot forward?
Well, I think, there's a couple of interesting things in what Carla just said. One is whether or not if she believes that the lack of integrity of leadership is making a lot of women like herself just not aspire for those jobs because she doesn't feel like they're worth aspiring to, is, I think, an important point. And the other one is, she mentioned she's doing contract work now. We have looked at and noticed that the rate of women, that they may leave bigger companies, but there's a high level of entrepreneurship. So a lot of women-owned businesses or smaller organizations where they can have more flexibility as well as be involved in the leadership of the companies. And so I think there might be a bit of a trend. Our research didn't go this far to prove it, but that many of those women where the aspirations for top jobs in bigger companies might have waned decided to go and do something else on a smaller scale or on their own where they could be in more control of what is valued, what is rewarded at a different environment. So I think there's something to that in terms of seeing high levels of entrepreneurship and consultancy type work by women in the workplace these days.
Carla, thanks a lot for that call. And we're going to go next to Marcia in Appleton. Hi, Marcia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
Well, I'm kind of on the same page as Carla. I actually left my last employer because of the management, which was a female. And I am a master's level professional. And I will say for kind of a broad base in an academic setting, what I noticed was there was a lack of support for child care, for family issues, for health concerns, for having a flexible schedule. There seemed to be a great deal of their interest in moving up, but that had a direct negative impact on our staff, and definitely a lack of collaboration, which I think is a key leadership style no matter where you work. And over a period of time, it just became important for me to move on so that I could find the work environment that best met my skill set.
Okay, Marcia, just really quickly before I let you go, are you saying that because it was women in these roles that you think there's something going on with women in leadership in general, or is this true maybe of men in leadership roles that you've worked with too?
I would have to say women in leadership. I think it is a role that is fairly new to some different realms or some different academic settings, perhaps, other settings, but their skill sets did not match what their employees needed.
Marcia, thank you so much for your thoughts. And Julie, is there something there, Marcia, pointing to women leaders who did not promote the most flexible or family-friendly policies? As we wrap up, what would you say to that?
Well, I think there's certainly some comments that's been out there for a long time saying, are women leaders doing enough for the women coming behind them, right? And that have the pioneers that sort of made it through on their own done enough to break that glass ceiling for everybody else? And to me, it's a little bit individual by individual. It's hard to overgeneralize into all women leaders or all male leaders. What I do believe is that, in general, the programs and policies are an important starting position. And foundationally, companies need to have those sorts of flexible policies and mindsets. However, a lot of what our research was about was saying what happens day to day, every day, working with that direct supervisor, and how can those relationships be enhanced to try and help people not lose those aspirations too early on in their careers.
Yeah, we leave it there. Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Julie Coffin, a partner at Bain & Company, talking about what organizations can do to close the gender gap among leadership positions.
Horse racing history was made this weekend with American Pharoah winning the Belmont Stakes victory number 3 on the road to a Triple Crown.
And that, by the way, is the first Triple Crown winner in 37 years in horse racing circles. That is a really big deal. Here's the key moment.
And here it is. The 37-year wait is over. American Pharoah is finally the one. American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown.
I'm not a horse racing guy. You're more into this, I think, than I am, Veronica. The Triple Crown, you got to win the Belmont Stakes, which American Pharoah did on Saturday. Mm-hmm. Kentucky Derby, of course. And the third one is Preakness?
The Preakness Stakes.
Preakness Stakes. Okay. All right. And this is 37 years since the last one.
So this is a really long wait for this. And it's always really exciting. It was fun to read about some of the grooms who were saying that if American Pharoah did become the Triple Crown winner, they would kind of be scared to take care of this horse. I mean, how much this horse is worth now.
Yeah. Very valuable horse now. As I understand it, the 12th ever, this does not happen all the time, 12th ever Triple Crown winner, 1978, the last one affirmed.
And Affirmed was one. I remember the name Secretariat. I mean, you're not a horse racing guy, and you remember some of these names anyway.
Yeah. Well, exciting news for horse racing fans.